Okay, so here we are. It is November 9th, 2019. Oh, press that button too. November 9th, 2019. We are at Narkees Street Congregation in Jerusalem, and we're looking at Leviticus this morning from the triennial Parashah. And for those who have y'all been here before?
A few years ago.
Okay. Well, welcome back. It's great to have you. Did you get one of these handouts here? Okay, so we're going to be looking at some of these scriptures this morning, but mainly this is for you on your own to go home and use and look up and study. And we're going to be looking at some of the prophetic readings that go along with Leviticus. And I know Leviticus is not a very popular book among evangelicals. It's often connected to sacrifice and blood and diseases and bodily discharges and who you cannot have sex with. But there's also some other things.
Leviticus.
But there's also always these little hidden diamonds maybe in there. I mean, all of these other things are also diamonds too. Diamonds in the rough maybe that we don't actually have a background for. So we might touch on some of them. But for instance, Leviticus has the year of Jubilee, and that's a huge concept in Christianity, especially connected to Jesus. It's also got the Day of Atonement, which is often used in the New Testament, like in the Epistle to the Hebrews and other connections again to Jesus. And so we're going to touch on some of this, but we just want to give a brief overview of some of these readings. So let's just start off with the first one. The number here, you see the symbol for number at the top here. We're going to be looking at number 74, and so that's the beginning of Leviticus.
You could almost get it behind your head, but not quite.
Well, I could just back it up or center it like this. So let's turn to Leviticus 1, and because we don't have a lot of time, we're not going to be reading
a
large part of the verses here, but
Leviticus 1:1 until what? Where should we go?
Just look at Leviticus 1. Look at the headings that your Bibles have. What does it say there? For what is Leviticus 1 about?
The burnt offering.
Sorry?
The burnt offering.
Thank you. What other headings do you see going down? Leviticus 2, for instance.
The grain offering.
You say fellowship offering? Yep. And so I think it's like the first seven chapters of Leviticus. You're dealing with the different sacrifices, the different offerings. And if you go over to the Haftarah, that's the second column here, next to Leviticus 1, the prophetic readings. Let's just go to Micah. That's the first reading there. And you can obviously keep Leviticus handy if you have a bookmark or something. But go to Micah 6.
Micah 6, verse 9. I don't have blessings. You don't have what?
I can't stay for reading. I don't
have blessings. Ah, well, then you can listen as we read aloud.
Okay, why don't you
read? Okay. Okay.
Micah 6.
So this is right after the iconic verse, "He has shown you, O man, what is good, what the Lord requires of you." In verse 9, "Listen, the Lord is calling to the city. It is wise to respect your authority, O Lord. Listen, O nation, and those assembled in the city. I will not overlook, O sinful house, the dishonest gain you have hoarded away, or the smaller-than-standard measure I hate so much. I do not condone the use of rigged scales or a bag of deceptive weights. The city's rich men think nothing of resorting to violence. Her inhabitants lie. Their tongues speak deceptive words. I will strike you brutally and destroy you because of your sin. You will eat but not be satisfied. Even if you have the strength to overtake some prey, you will not be able to carry it away. If you do happen to carry away something, I will deliver it over to the sword. You will plant crops, but you will not harvest them. You will squeeze oil from the olives, but you will have no oil to rub on your bodies. You will squeeze juice from the grapes, but you will have no wine to drink. You implement the regulations of Omri and all the practices of Ahav's dynasty. You follow their policies. Therefore, I will make you an appalling sight. The city's inhabitants will be taunted derisively, and nations will mock all of you.
And I could just jump in here. If you go back to, like, say, verse 6, this isn't necessarily in the reading here, but it's obviously in the chapter of Micah 6. What do you see there in Micah 6, 6, 6, 7? Right, it's talking about, you know, should I enter the Lord's presence with burnt offerings, with year-old calves? Verse 7, will the Lord accept 1,000 rams, 10,000 streams of olive oil? Should I give my firstborn child as payment for my rebellion, my offspring, my own flesh and blood for my sin? Going back to Leviticus, right, 1, Leviticus 2, Leviticus 3, we're dealing with all of these offerings and sacrifices, and the point of sacrifice.
I'm sorry.
No problem.
I can't stand with it. It's like.
Sure thing.
Listening.
Sure. So Micah here is obviously talking about the sacrificial system that's coming out of Leviticus, and what you just read, Sharon. What are these examples that Micah is giving?
Moral behavior. Like dishonesty,
like cheating.
Cheating people, lying.
Taking advantage.
Right. And they tend to be more kind of subtle things. But there's a crossover here from ceremony to morality. And it's like using ceremony as a picture for moral and immoral behavior.
What? You want to explain the whole thing with purity and impurity in Leviticus?
Okay. So, it's a big thing, and we'll keep circling back to this in Leviticus.
But this is foundational to understand the whole book.
So, in the ancient world, you have this concept of clean and unclean. Ceremonial of clean and ceremonial unclean. And being ceremonially clean means you're in a state of wholeness and readiness to go into a holy area. It is not a sin to be unclean. It's just inappropriate to be unclean and come into a holy place.
For example.
And for example.
Like, give me an example. Like if you're menstruating.
If you're menstruating, if you've had sex with your wife, if you have some kind of skin disease. There are various lists of things that would render you unclean. If you just had a baby.
Yeah. It's not a sin to have a baby, right? Does everybody agree on that? but in that context.
It's beautiful and wonderful. There's nothing moral about it.
Right.
Right. But all the things that fall in the impure area, I would say, symbolize a lack of wholeness. And they actually. They are signs of our mortality, our humanness. And so thereby, are signs of mortality. And so that separates us from the divine and the holy, who is immortal.
You remember priests are not allowed, if say their wife dies, or their family member, their son. But you remember Aaron's two sons got killed? He couldn't go and mourn for them.
Because you can't touch dead.
That mortality that you're talking about.
Yeah. And actually, the whole reproduction system and having children is a response to us being mortal. Because we don't live forever. We have children. And they live for us. They carry on our name. And so that is a blessed system, but it is also a system of mortality. And whereas God is eternal, and God doesn't... He is forever. You know, he is immortal and eternal and holy and whole, complete. So anything lacking or that's cyclical or incomplete, it would be on the impure side.
So for this introduction, Leviticus has this worldview and it's bringing it forth of what's pure, what's impure. And a lot of this is obviously ceremonial. It's not necessarily, it's not dealing with moral sin if you've had a baby, right? Or... etc. But when we come to the prophets, and as you start to read that second column of the Haftarah, for instance, here in Micah 6, starting off, the prophets are going to, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, here in Micah, they're going to focus on what is practicalities of people not being moral, not actually, it's not about whether they've, the blood of giving birth now becomes related to sinful actions. Because who's a woman often, like say in Isaiah? Who's symbolized as a woman in Ezekiel? The city Jerusalem. Sorry, I'm like throwing it out there, like, you know, saying, but Jerusalem is a woman. She's often portrayed as a woman, and we're going to read some of those passages. But like in Ezekiel talks about, you know, I found you out in the wilderness, bleeding, and, you know, left by your lovers, and so you obviously could easily allude back to Leviticus with all of these passages connected to blood flow.
And what combines these things are two things can make you unclean. There's a ceremonial uncleanliness that's just human stuff that is not connected to morality but makes you unclean. And then sins make you unclean. And because both of those have a common denominator of being unclean, it becomes this great metaphor for then the prophets to take on and use as this picture of sinfulness. It adds a picture. You can picture this because you have something physical to look at. And so when you describe Jerusalem as this, you know, you're sitting there in your blood, and you can picture this, the sins, as something palpable, symbolic, and gross. And it gives you some idea to relate to. And of course, prophets are always trying to bring it home to you and give you pictures that would help you understand what God is after. And the pictures are shocking, frankly.
Right, because, like, what is Isaiah? I think it's Isaiah, is it chapter 1? He says, yeah. your sins are like what? Minstrel rags.
Yeah.
Right?
It's supposed to gross you out. That's the idea. And so it's trying to give you a visual.
And who is Isaiah, chapter 1? Who's he talking to here? Jerusalem. We're gonna look at it at the very end. But look at Micah 6, 9, the very first verse that we read. What's the first few words say? The Lord is calling to
the city.
The city. He's calling to the city. He's calling to Jerusalem. So just keep that in mind as well. And maybe we should just look at Isaiah 48 real quick, those few verses to counterbalance. You've got the city that's in sin. And Isaiah 48.
By the way, Isaiah, as part of the prophets, they're always trying to connect this ceremony with morality. It's the same thing if you read in what's known as a holiness code in Leviticus, further on in the chapter, like chapter 18, 19 through early 20s. Also, Leviticus connects the ceremony with the morality, saying they're both important. And when you do the one, your motive is the other. And it's interesting that the prophets bring up that, and then later on in the New Testament, you have that continuation, that same emphasis.
So I just want to touch on a couple of these verses, and then we're going to go on to the next section here. Isaiah 48:12, listen to me, Jacob, Israel, whom I have called, I am he. I am the first, and I am the last. And I just want to emphasize that word. God has called Israel. He's called them. And what has he called them to? All right? And so skip down to verse 17. This is what the Lord says, your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. I am the Lord your God, who teaches you what is best for you, who directs you in the way you should go. If only you had paid attention to my commands, your peace would have been like a river, your well-being like the waves of the sea. Okay, verse 20. Leave Babylon, flee from the Babylonians. Right, they're currently captive in Babylon. Announce this with shouts of joy and proclaim it. Send it out to the ends of the earth. Say the Lord has redeemed his servant Jacob. They did not thirst when he led them through the deserts. He made water flow for them from the rock. He split the rock and water gushed out. Obviously, God here is alluding to the whole Exodus story, the wilderness. There is no peace, says the Lord, for the wicked. And then as you go into 49, those first three verses, he says, listen to me, you islands, hear this, you distant nations. Before I was born, the Lord called me. From my mother's womb, he has spoken my name. He made my mouth like a sharpened sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me into a polished arrow and concealed me in his quiver. He said to me, you are my servant, Israel, in whom I will display my splendor. And so this is kind of that. This encapsulates why there was Leviticus, right? Why is there a Leviticus? Why is this whole ceremonial? Why are there these things that you can eat and you cannot eat? And why do you act a certain way? It's because God has called his people to a specific purpose. And Isaiah is enunciating this. And it's not just about how you dress and what you look like and what you eat, but it's about how you act. That's what the prophets will try to bang home over and over. All of your exterior stuff does not matter if the interior is not circumcised. If you know, it doesn't matter if you're physically circumcised if you are not internally, your heart is not circumcised. And so I think this is a good kind of introduction to the purpose of Leviticus from a prophetic view. So,
shall we go to Leviticus 12? Yeah. So look now to Leviticus 12.
That would be on the...
It's number 82.
Page 2. Page 2.
Leviticus 12, 1 through 13, 17. And that's being paired in our triennial Haftarah with Isaiah 9, 5 and Isaiah 66, 7. So that's kind of cool. So we're going to look at what these places are. Leviticus 12 is about what to do when you have a baby, right? You're just discussing how having children is a blessing, and yet it renders you ceremonially impure. Tell the Israelites, when a woman produces offspring and bears a male child, she will be unclean 7 days, as she is unclean during the days of her menstruation. On the eighth day, the flesh of his foreskin must be circumcised. Then she will remain 33 days in blood purity. She must not touch anything holy, and she must not enter the sanctuary until the days of her purification are fulfilled. Okay, and then if she has a female, it's like double the time. I don't know why. Okay, skip down to verse 8. If she cannot afford a sheep, then she must take 2 turtle doves or 2 young pigeons, one for a burnt offering and one for a sin offering. And the priest is to make atonement on her behalf, and she will be clean. Interesting, huh? So impurity of any kind needs atonement. Atonement brings you back to wholeness. Again, she has not sinned by having a child, and yet she needs atonement. So there's this whole system that you have to enter into to understand this. And so, you know, you have the unclean aspect that needs to be made clean. The lacking needs to be made whole. And the process of that is called atonement. And that becomes a perfect metaphor for sin, because when we sin, we're lacking. We miss the target, and then we need to be made whole again. That's atonement.
This is the same word for Day of Atonement, right? From Leviticus 16.
That's how the woman has, that's how she can't go to the synagogue.
Right.
She's unclean.
Well, that's been a transference of the temple to synagogue, which is interesting because synagogue is not actually holy in the same way a temple is. But that's another.
It's easy to think about that one story with Jesus, right, where that woman has been bleeding for 12 years and she's unclean, and so she's basically socially ostracized.
And for her to touch him.
Yes.
Took a lot of courage and humble.
Yes.
Right.
Being unclean.
Because theoretically, it should have made Jesus unclean. And yet somehow in that context, his power of cleanness overpowers her uncleanness.
Yeah, but the people watching are probably saying, what is she doing?
Yeah, so first,
did she get stoned from that?
No. You wouldn't be stoned.
No, by the people, not because she's touching her and she's unclean, him and she's unclean.
Well, here's the thing about being unclean. It doesn't, if Jesus were unclean, he would simply wait and become clean again. Jesus, by being, we're going to get there in a second. We're going to get there in
just
a second.
Hold it for a second.
Isaiah 9:5, look at that briefly. It's interesting that in this triennial Haftarah, they've connected this Leviticus 12 to Isaiah 9:5. And the Isaiah 9:5, you'll recognize, is a messianic passage.
One of the verses following.
For a child has been born to us, a son has been given to us.
That's 9:6.
Sorry, that's 9...
6 in English.
6 in English, 5 in Hebrew.
Okay, sorry. 6
in the numbering is a little off. So in Hebrew text, it's verse 5, which is identical to your verse 6 if you're reading in English.
Yeah, you're reading in English, verse 6.
For a child has been born to us, a son has been given to us. He shoulders responsibility and is called Extraordinary Strategist. Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. His dominion will be vast, and he will bring immeasurable prosperity. He will rule on David's throne and over David's kingdom, establishing it and strengthening it by promoting justice and fairness from this time forward and forevermore. The Lord's intense devotion to his people will accomplish this.
Now,
I'm correcting Wonderful Counselor's Extraordinary Strategy.
Wonderful Counselor.
Now, what does that remind you of? Okay, so obviously we know the whole connection here, messianic connection with the descendant of David being like the Messiah here. But the connection here with Leviticus 12, where is Leviticus 12 quoted in the New Testament?
Did you read it out loud?
Leviticus 12.
It's about the childbirth. When you give birth to a son, you have to remain away from the temple for a while, and then you're supposed to bring a sacrifice.
Are you talking about the Mary?
That's right.
Yes, so go to Luke 2.
Luke 2, verse 22.
Well, go to maybe 21 to start.
Okay.
For the context. I'll read it. Luke 2, 21. On the eighth day, when it was time to circumcise the child, he was named Jesus, the name the angel had given him before he was conceived. By the way, we're going to, just an advertisement, our congregation is going to go to Nazareth on December 13th, if you'd like to go, and because this is where the angel gave his name, right? So we'll go into that later. But that's December 13th. It's a Friday. Verse 22. When the time came for the purification rites required by the law of Moses, Joseph and Mary took him to Jerusalem to present him to the Lord, as it is written in the law of the Lord. Every firstborn male is to be consecrated to the Lord and to offer a sacrifice in keeping with what is said in the law of the Lord, a pair of doves or two young pigeons.
That's, of course, if you remember Leviticus, if you can't afford a lamb, if you can't afford a lamb, you're allowed to bring two doves instead of two lambs. And so obviously Mary and Joseph were on the poorer side of the scale because they couldn't afford a lamb or lambs.
Lower middle class.
Two doves.
But it's interesting here. Here you have... We often connect Jesus to the Isaiah 9:6 in English. And here you have Leviticus 12. And it's tied in straight to his story. And here in this triennial parasha, you have those two connected, Leviticus 12 with Isaiah 9:6. So.
And here you see the impurity as strictly impurity, not a sin. Obviously, Jesus never sinned, and yet he was impure by just being born as a human. You have childbirth blood on you, and that makes you impure for a set amount of days. And so she brings this sacrifice to be made whole again, to be made pure again.
And on the side, I just want to note, do you see Isaiah 66, which is right next to Isaiah 9 on that? What's Isaiah 66 say? What's it talking about here? For all those who work in Aliyah? Well, let me just read it.
Before she goes into labor, she gives birth. Before her contractions begin, she delivers a boy. Who has ever heard of such a thing? Who has ever seen this? Can a country be brought forth in one day? Can a nation be born in a single moment? Yet as soon as Zion goes into labor, she gives birth to sons. Do I bring a baby to the birth opening and then not deliver it? Asks the Lord. Or do I bring a baby to the point of delivery and then hold it back? Asks your God. Be happy for Jerusalem and rejoice with her, all you who love her. Share in her great joy, all you who have mourned over her. For you will nurse from her satisfying breasts and be nourished. You will feed with joy from her milk-filled breasts.
So, this kind of, again, if you've been following this whole triennial, we keep talking about Jerusalem keeps being brought up all the time. And obviously, if the prophets who are writing in the time of Jerusalem, which is the center of the world in their perspective, that would make sense. And so Jerusalem has a very significant focus in all of these readings. And you could also tie it back into Jesus as well, because where's Jesus when he's circumcised and having the offering brought? He's in Jerusalem. That's where you would go, the temple. So it's kind of a nice little tie together of that whole story with Isaiah 66. Yep.
Okay, so with that, let's go to
page 3,
number 87 on your reading. It's taken from Leviticus 15. Leviticus 15, verse 25. Okay. This, all of 15, talks about impurity of discharges, specifically women. And then it goes into chapter 16, after the death of Aaron's two sons, when they approached the presence of the Lord and died.
I mean, it's the Day of Atonement.
The need to be atoned for.
But I don't think it's focusing on this with Ezekiel.
No, so with Ezekiel,
he's focusing on
the first part, this image of defilement.
This woman with a discharge of blood.
This impurity that comes from anything.
So I would imagine here this woman again. Jesus, 12 years, she's got blood flowing. This is this woman right here, Leviticus 15:25.
The same woman?
No, I mean, it's talking about her situation. Yeah.
Anyone who has an unusual bleeding or discharge would then remain in this impurity and be cut off from coming to the tabernacle or temple. And so this...
It's like not being able to celebrate
right.
And it also affects everybody else. Anyone else who would want to be in their home,
family.
It's more than just her not being on her.
Right. So the level of feeling cut off that she would bear is really high. So Ezekiel 16:9 is paired with this passage, and it's again seeing Jerusalem, and maybe all of Jerusalem is a symbol of the people, really.
Are you telling us to turn to Ezekiel 16:9?
Ezekiel 16:9.
Okay, yes. Ezekiel 16.
It says, then I bathed you in water, washed the blood off you, and anointed you with fragrant oil. I dressed you in embroidered clothing and put fine leather sandals on your feet. I wrapped you with fine linen and covered you with silk. I adorned you with jewelry. I put bracelets on your hands and a necklace around your neck. I put a ring in your nose, earrings on your ears, and a beautiful crown on your head. You were adorned with gold and silver, while your clothing was of fine linen, silk, and embroidery. You ate the finest flour, honey, and olive oil. You became extremely beautiful and attained the position of royalty. Your fame spread among the nations because of your beauty. Your beauty was perfect because of the splendor which I bestowed on you, declares the Sovereign Lord. So,
well, let's just read the other two passages that are right there. So you have Ezekiel 16 we just read. Look at Isaiah 4:4. And just for time's sake, I'll read. The Lord will wash away the filth of the women of Zion. He will cleanse the bloodstains from Jerusalem by a spirit of judgment and a spirit of fire. And so, you know, if you're reading this just straight up, you know, obviously you understand what it's saying, but if you understand it in the context of Leviticus 15:25, and also with the story of the woman that Jesus is dealing with, it's a very powerful, almost unfair image, especially for this woman. Like, what did I do? Why, you know, how now all of this thing can kind of sit on me, even though it's just a metaphor, right? It's not, it's just like when that man who was healed from blindness, and they, you know, the question was, well, who sinned? Was it his parents or did he? And I mean, even today, you know, when the tsunami happens, who sinned? You know, why did the earthquake happen in this country? Somehow it's embedded in us as humans, mm-hmm. to ask why, right. You know, why me or why them or, and
just like it's embedded in us to think we can do something right to not earn that.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. To, what's the word? To satisfy the gods? Or
appease?
To appease, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting here in parallel in verse 4, it actually says the excrement. He's going to wash off excrement and blood.
This is the translation filth here you're talking about.
Filth.
Yeah.
It's so'ah. It's what comes out of you after you eat food. Which is also a human process that, you know, thank God, that's a very important process. We can't live without it. However, it's a symbol of yuckiness, which is the same thing as the blood metaphor. And so it can be used here as a powerful symbol.
It's like what these guys said, though. You know, the woman with the issue of blood not only impacts her, but her family and anyone who touches her.
Mm-hmm.
And so, just in the challenge of this, to ever purify her or anyone around her, such is the power of the Lord to purify Jerusalem.
Yeah, that like you have that a lot in Isaiah, that the whole city is going to be pure, and you're not going to find any impurity anywhere inside that city. It's like it's a center of pureness that's going to radiate out. Which is interesting when you go back to that story with Jesus. It's almost like his purity is so strong it kind of covers her, kind of just radiates out. Have you ever noticed if a woman gets on a bus and there's a religious man, they won't sit next to a woman, just in case.
Because that's why she's touching Jesus. How did they react to that?
But the thing is, it's silliness anyway, because any impurity is timed. Impurity is timed. After you wash yourself, after 7 days, it goes away.
Yeah, but Jesus was not holy to those people. She wasn't touching holiness. They didn't see him as holy.
Okay, so that's,
yeah.
That's the answer.
And she brought the appropriate offering after. She's following.
We knew he was holy, but
right.
Yeah. You know,
right. Like, what would they do today? If they knew she was holy.
Well, what you're touching on, though, I think it's the mystery of the incarnation. Because you have a holy God that takes on humanness. And by definition, humanness can become impure. By definition, there's no such thing as human that's not impure. So you have this juxtaposition where you have the holy eternal that's taking on flesh that is by nature mortal and impure. And that's a bit of a mystery.
You can be impure but not be sin.
Exactly. That's the point.
There's impurity in sin.
And we have so conflated the two that it's hard for us to disentangle it. Where Leviticus shows us clearly that there's the two things involved. But what happened is the prophets used that metaphor because it was so nice to be able to picture sins that now we come from the New Testament perspective, look through the prophets at the Torah, and we've just conflated the two. So to be impure is sin, but it's not.
Right.
Also, as evangelicals, we've never even been taught that there was this concept
right.
of impurities and a legal yeah. code that has to do with impurities that had nothing to do with immorality.
Right. Because our worldview is so different, and we're coming from a different culture.
Well, I would actually argue it's the prophets who have made us that way, because...
Well, that's what I was just saying, okay. That they've used it as that picture, because it works so well.
Right, but I'm saying as evangelicals, our tradition has fed from the prophets.
Yeah, we look through the prophets at the Torah.
When you say fed from the prophets, what's the prophets you think they've been?
That when we read Leviticus, we actually don't read Leviticus. We read Isaiah, Jeremiah, reading Leviticus, their understanding. So
that leads to cheap grace and sinning all the more. Because you have that.
If you don't have the background of Leviticus only,
exactly.
You could take the prophets and say, "Oh, to be impure is to be sinful."
Mm-hmm.
But they're actually using it the other way. They're just trying to use it as a picture of what our sinfulness looks like to God. In the same way that stuff that belongs in the toilet looks gross to us, that's
well,
how our sin looks to God. So they're using it as a picture.
Right, our sin are menstrual rags.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they're not saying that going to the toilet is a sin.
Right.
And so... And told to a people who already has those laws and has internalized this system of impurity, it would make the point of the prophets pungent, but it wouldn't cause them to be confused. But because we're coming from a different culture and we don't have that worldview of pure and impure, we could easily then transfer it the wrong way and say, oh, all impurity is sin, and then you kind of run into problems.
And I'd like to push forward with that because we don't have a lot of time. Go back to 84, number 84 on page 2. Talking about impurity, we've been talking about blood. Leprosy is the term
yeah.
we use, even though it's not really leprosy. It's...
If you were to look at the biggest impurity-causing things, first thing is childbirth. The second, well, the two that are tied next are leprosy and menstruation.
Yeah, skin stuff
yeah.
is what you might translate it as.
Well, yeah, it's a skin disease. It was not Hansen's disease, which is what we call leprosy,
yeah.
but it was a skin disease.
The Hansen house here in Jerusalem.
Leprosy. What has traditionally been translated leprosy? I'll put it
but,
this way.
But we don't have time to go into all of those details, but if you look at 84, which is Leviticus 14. No, it's Leviticus 14, verse 1. It's that chapter. If we're just talking about what we call, usually call as leprosy or skin diseases, it has for the prophetic reading Isaiah 57 and verse 14.
Oh, also death is in here. Childbirth, right. Childbirth is 1 week.
Talks about here in Isaiah 57. I live in a high and holy place, but also with the one who is contrite and lowly in spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. I will not accuse them forever, nor I will always be angry. for then they would faint away because of me, the very people I have created. I was enraged by their sinful greed. I punished them, and I hid my face in anger, yet they kept on in their willful ways. I have seen their ways, but I will heal them. And so the emphasis here is, I will heal them. And this is that same idea of when someone has a skin disease, you set them apart, you watch it, you shave it, you shave the area to make sure that you can watch what it does. And Jeremiah 30, verse 17, which is right there in the bold. Jeremiah 30, 17. Same thing here. The context is, I will restore you to health. I will restore you to health and heal your wounds, declares the Lord, because you are called an outcast. And then who's he talking about?
Zion.
Zion, for whom no one cares. So again, you've got this city of Jerusalem is being used, this metaphor of someone with wounds. And often people might have thought of, you know, you got beat up, or but it could be this allusion to you've got some sickness that your body has these, something on the outside that says, hey, I'm sick, I'm suffering from something. And it, this interpretation here ties it into, you know, the leprosy idea. And then you think, again, back to Jesus, with all the time he heals the lepers, right? These colonies or these guys that are wandering around ostracized. Again, so much of Leviticus is so important to understand for our understanding of Jesus.
Yeah. And again, the Jerusalem as a city naturally is given to a woman metaphor, because city in Hebrew is feminine. The word is feminine. And so you naturally think of woman, just like in French, liberta, right? Liberty is a woman. And so we have the Statue of Liberty in America, the Lady Liberty enlightening the world. And so your abstract concept naturally is given to a female
personification,
because the word is feminine in that language. So should we go on to our...
So let's go to the last page, kind of to the conclusion here.
Number 87 on your text page.
Wait, where?
Number 87, right? Sorry. We already did that.
No, 96.
Sorry. 96.
Page 4, 96. Leviticus 25, 35. If you turn there, what's Leviticus 25 saying? 35, verse 30, starting in verse 35. What's the whole chapter of Leviticus 25 about? It's one of my favorite chapters in the Bible. Jubilee. Yeah. Jubilee. The year of Jubilee. Not in this chapter, but... Yeah, but it's... You got Jubilee, you're blowing the shofar, and what are the things that happen in the Jubilee? There's three main things.
All the debts are forgiven.
Restoration of the property to the family, and those who are in debt as slaves, indentured, they're set free. Those are kind of your main things to remember there. So look here in verse 35.
Restoration of property. What else did he say? Debts
and slaves. So, it says, if any of your fellow Israelites become poor and are unable to support themselves among you, and it goes into basically how they become indentured, because you're not technically supposed to make them a slave if they're from your people, but then after that whole time passes, they're freed at the year of Jubilee. That's in verse 40. Okay, that's the context. What is the prophetic reading there? Okay, so let's turn to Isaiah 35. And I find this very fascinating. Isaiah 35. I'll just read it, verse 3. Strengthen the feeble hands, steady the knees that give way, say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear. You know, you can easily think of somebody's being freed, you're coming out of slavery, you know, you're coming out of prison. You think about prisoners today who come out of prison, they've been incarcerated for a while, and getting used to freedom is difficult in some cases. Say to those with fearful hearts, be strong, do not fear, your God will come. He will come with vengeance. Okay, keep this in mind. Vengeance. Isaiah is often talking about slaves. Who's Isaiah's slaves in his historical context? Who are these slaves?
Israel,
or specifically Judah and Jerusalem in Babylon. They've been enslaved by the Babylonians. And you have all these prophecies. You're going to go free. You're going to go through the desert. There's going to be a road in the desert. You're going to return to the land. And they're essentially coming out of slavery. Okay? And there's this vengeance involved. He will come to save you. Verse 5. Isaiah 35, verse 5. Then will the eyes of the blind be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then will the lame leap like a deer, and the mute tongue shout for joy. Water will gush forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert. And this is where it starts to get interesting here. In what we just read, the eyes of the blind will be opened, the ears of the deaf unstopped, the lame will leap like deer, and the mute tongue will shout for joy. A slave was not rich, right? A slave was poor. So go back to Jesus' beginning of his ministry. He's in Nazareth. He's reading from the scroll of Isaiah. He's not reading Isaiah 35. What does he read? Isaiah 61. And what are those words? Right, but what...
The words he read.
To restore sight to the blind. And, but it starts off, the Lord's anointed me to preach good news to the poor. And so you have this poverty, this poor. Like, who are we talking about? Obviously, if you go back to the Jubilee, you can be talking about financial debts, financial poor. But as we were saying, the prophets are starting to use these metaphors that might have had to do with something to do, which was... ceremonial or something that had to do with economical, but it starts to take on a spiritual meaning. So your debts now become sins. Your impurity now becomes sin. And so what's interesting is he's reading from Isaiah 61. He's talking about good news to the poor, opening eyes to the blind, freeing the oppressed, the day proclaiming the year of the Lord, and then he stops there. But what did he not read? What was the next part of Isaiah 61 too? The day of vengeance of our God. And look, you know, you go back to Isaiah 35, you have this vengeance, you have the eyes of the blind being opened, the ears of the deaf. Because remember when John the Baptist sent he's in prison. Right? Again, here we are. We have prisoners. John the Baptist is a prisoner, and his disciples go to Jesus. Are you the coming one? Are you the Messiah? And what does Jesus respond with? With the fruit. The blind see, the deaf hear, the lepers. That's interesting. The guys with the skin, you know, that sets them outside of the community. And it ends with the poor have the good news preached to them. And so it's very fascinating that you have here...
It's a conscious omission.
Yeah.
On Jesus' part. He stops
before the vengeance.
The verse.
Right, with the vengeance part.
Yeah.
But the vengeance still has to come.
It will come,
it,
right.
It will. There is judgment, right? It's not... Sometimes people like to paint Jesus as this kind of... guy who's just
flowers and butterflies.
Like nothing matters anymore.
But there's a full circle
right.
involved here. And so coming back to what we're looking at here,
of Leviticus 25, it's interesting they've woven Isaiah 35 together here, and you see so many elements that are part of Jesus' story and where he's coming from.
And to carry on this theme of recovery of sight to the blind,
yes,
in Isaiah 61, you have this word in Hebrew, pekach koach. And it's a weird form. It just says, like, opening. Like, it doesn't really say what it is, but lifkoach is what eyes do. And ears could do it, too. But particularly eyes. And so, but the understanding, because it's in the context of people who are bound up, people who are captive, normally when you put somebody who is deserving of jail...
Today, you put somebody in a cell, and they have light, and they have a TV, and they've got all these amenities. What was the ancient jail?
It was usually a broken cistern.
It was a hole.
A hole in the ground.
There are no windows.
If you go in one today, and you turn off your flashlight, it is dark. You are living in constant darkness. And so there's that contrast of someone who has been sitting in darkness because they're a captive. Can you imagine being brought out to daylight? And, like, nothing, you'd feel like an earthworm.
Well, you would be blind first.
Yes.
You couldn't see.
Because it would be sudden brightness.
It would take
brightness.
So long to your eyes to adjust.
And the interesting thing with this word, pekach koach, was interpreted as blindness so far back that even when the Greeks first translated the Hebrew Bible, they translated that recovery of sight to the blind.
Yes.
Because... How do you understand this?
This
opening.
Yeah.
Anyway, so there's this theme of being brought out of slavery or
darkness.
Captivity or jail, and being freed. And there's that symbol of, you know, darkness to the light, and where the light is a healing of the blindness or a healing from having been in darkness.
NIV has a release from darkness for the prisoners.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Interesting. Let's see, what does NET have?
Yeah, it's also interesting to me that I think if you were in captivity in the dark and you were brought out into the light, it would be uncomfortable.
Right.
For quite some time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's also something that happens as the Lord conforms us to...
Yep.
Yeah.
The image of Christ is not always comfortable.
Eustace, in C.S. Lewis's book, when Eustace is turned into a dragon,
and then
to go through that peeling off of the dragon back to being a human, it's painful, but it's good. It's a good process.
How about we end with this? The very last one here. Well, no, it's not the very last one, but number 97, Leviticus 26.
Which is right after the passage we just read.
Yes. And going back to the introduction about what is Leviticus about, what's the whole big picture? You have here at the end of Leviticus the same thing you have kind of going on in Deuteronomy at the very end. You know, it talks about the blessings and the curses. If you obey God's word and you do what he says, you're going to be rewarded. And if you don't, you'll be punished. And so just here in 26, you know, don't make idols. Verse 2, observe the Sabbath. Verse 3 is kind of summarizes it. If you follow my decrees and are careful to obey my commands, then these are the blessings. And then later you have the curses. What is the prophetic reading that's connected here? It's Isaiah chapter 1. Okay, and let's just end here this morning. I think this is a good summary of kind of what we've tried to discuss for all of these readings. And it's verse 19 is where we'll just read from there.
Are you going to read?
You're welcome to.
If you have a willing attitude and obey, then you will eat You will again eat the good crops of the land.
Sorry, stop. So, you saw we just read Leviticus 26:3. What did it just say? If you obey, then I will send rain for the crops. So.
But if you refuse and rebel, you will be devoured by the sword. Or literally, you will be eaten by the sword. So you have this flip. If you follow, you will eat. If you don't follow, you'll be eaten. Know for certain that the Lord has spoken. How tragic that the once faithful city has become a prostitute. She was once a center of justice. Fairness resided in her, but now only murderers. Oh, and that, sorry, we got to read that one in Hebrew. Listen. Well, that kind of ties back to the image of Isaiah 5.
Then we got to that part.
But Mileti Mishpat Tzedek Yalimba Vata Meratzim.
I think it's 27 that you're on reading.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. Okay, so get down to 27. You've got to read in Hebrew.
Right, but do 22 and read the rest of them.
Okay.
Your silver has become dross.
Your silver has become scum. Your beer is diluted with water. Your officials are rebels. They associate with thieves. All of them love bribery and look for payoffs. They do not take up the cause of the orphan or defend the rights of the widow. Therefore, the sovereign Lord who commands armies, the powerful ruler of Israel, says this. Ah, I will seek vengeance against my adversaries.
Here's vengeance again. It's there.
I will take revenge against my enemies. I will attack you. I will purify your metal with flux. I will remove all your slag. I will reestablish honest judges, as in former times, wise advisors, as in earlier days. Then you will be called the just city, faithful town. Zion will be redeemed by justice, and her returnees by righteousness.
That's it.
Yeah. Only thing missing there is the Hebrew word order actually emphasizes how will Zion be redeemed? Through justice. Zion, that is, it says about Zion, Bemishpat Tipadeh. Zion with justice will be redeemed.
So the focus isn't the redemption, the focus is first the justice.
The justice will bring her redemption.
Yeah.
That's what's being focused.
And then you'll notice there's one more little reading there from the top of 97. It's Isaiah 2 in the first five verses. It's that famous section that we all...
The mountain of the Lord.
Why we all are here, right, this morning in Jerusalem. This is what... Isaiah, son of Amos, saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as the highest of the mountains. It will be exalted above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the temple of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways so that we may walk in his paths. The law will go out from Zion, the word of the Lord from Jerusalem. He will judge between the nations. He will settle disputes for many peoples. They will beat their swords in the plowshares and their spears in the pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore. Come, descendants of Jacob, let us walk in the light of the Lord. And we often, you know, this is the verse that's quoted at the United Nations. It's outside on the wall in New York City. And so it's often used as, you know, let's all have peace and come together. But if you read it all in the context of chapter 1, what we just read... In order for there to be peace and for there to be
prosperity,
you've got to follow the Lord's teachings. You've got to...
Which are just.
Yeah.
Fair.
That's right.
And good.
So, Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.